Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Poetry and Affairs of State and Renaissance Creativity, two conversations this week on Soundings. My guests are Howard Erskine Hill of the University of Cambridge and Joseph Lowenstein of Washington University. First, a discussion featuring Howard Erskine Hill about poetry and affairs of state. Following that, a conversation with Joseph Lowenstein about Renaissance creativity and the book trade. Here is Howard Erskine Hill.
I like to use the phrase affairs of state because it suggests visible history, the acts and claims of rulers, wars, rebellions, revolutions. If history is change, and perhaps there are those who might say that it is not, there are those who would say that it is not easily perceived. One thinks of Braudel and La Longue Durée as an historical concept.
This is a French historian, just parenthetically.
That's right. Putting particular stress on the long-term economy and trade of the Mediterranean basin. There are historians who say that the causes of change are always economic and social, scarcely visible until the sudden outbreaks to which they lead. And I think neo-Marxist history is forever proposing the rise of a middle class to explain conspicuous events,
indeed,
whereas the evidence for this often seems to be very hard to find.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm doing is concentrating on the most conspicuous and, if you like, outward face of history, and I do think it is that face of history to which the poets and the writers have most powerfully responded.
Is there a particular period in English literary history that you would have recourse to look for examples? Do you find a richer time, for example, in the Renaissance than the 18th century? How do you make those decisions?
I certainly do. I think the Renaissance, the 17th century, the period of the great civil war in Britain, and the 18th century, these are areas where literature is powerfully involved in public affairs. You have to accept that poetry was a form of propaganda. Even sometimes the highest, most successful poetry did have a propaganda function and was intended to do so.
One of the examples that you use is the work of John Dryden. Why would you single him out? What's special about him with respect to poetry and affairs of state?
He's been said to have been the first great English poet to be interested in history. There is some truth in that, although it's hardly fair to Milton or Spencer, perhaps, to single him out in that way.
Not to mention Shakespeare.
And not to mention Shakespeare. I think that Dryden has an extraordinary sharpness and mordancy of manner when he speaks of the kinds of people who affect changes in the state.
Are you telling me that he did not trust the politicians?
I certainly am. What his attitude was, you can perhaps gauge from three lines from his version of Dryden's Aeneid, where he talks about the councillor Drances, fascious and rich, bold at the council board, but cautious in the field, he shunned the sword, a close caballer and tongue-valiant lord. Well, that is a good shrewd, realistic, and vigorous description of a politician. I think there were politicians and there were kings that that Dryden did trust, or at any rate, to whom he felt his loyalty was due. on the one hand, in translating, he contrived to draw a parallel, not to propose an identity, but to draw a parallel between the wanderings of Aeneas after the burning and the fall of Troy, and the wanderings of the banished James II. That he did in the first half of his translation. In the second half, where we look at Aeneas from the point of view of the Italians who are invaded by the Trojans as they come to found their new empire, Dryden worked for parallels between Aeneas and William III, parallels which in one or two cases were not flattering to William III. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, Dryden was using a great classical poem as a way of thinking about the political and religious dilemma of 1688 to 89. And to that extent, poetry had a solution. To that extent, poetry was offering a positive example.
Well, I'm intrigued by the way you put that, Howard Erskine Hill, getting people to think about the problem. There isn't a necessary direct sort of
That's
answer
exactly right.
implicit. It is the raising of the issue.
I think we've had a false picture of the 18th century in the past. It's been seen as an age of peace and stability.
Order and reason.
Well, of course, there was some order and perhaps more reason. But what makes the 18th century special is that it started out in drastic civil war, mm-hmm. that one major party and body of religious and political opinion was proscribed from power, and the only way that party could attempt to retrieve its position was the way that any 18th century political body would act, that is, dynastically. Mm-hmm. And the importance then was to try and bring back the exiled Stuart dynasty, not entirely for ideological reasons, though they did often have an important sway in men's minds, but for very material and pragmatic reasons.
How do you figure out the difference between poetry, as it is typically characterized, the great thoughts of the great minds, that sort of thing, and propaganda, on the other hand? Do we simply neglect or lose the aesthetic dimension, and we retain the political, the social bite and satire?
There is a sort of sliding scale between writing which is mere low propaganda, seizing on the catchwords which expressed fear or hope in any political situation, and high poetry, which nevertheless often still does have a propaganda effect. Indeed, it is probably true to say that some of the finest political poetry that has been written has been partly spurred by propagandist motives.
Well, let me ask you to pause on an example, Howard Erskine Hill. In what ways is The Rape of the Lock political? Do you look upon that as typical, atypical? How would you treat that as you look at poetry and affairs of state?
Well, The Rape of the Lock is a very interesting and strange example, because on the face of it, it's a brilliantly witty poem about a family quarrel. But one does notice the changes that Pope, as poet, as a wordsmith, manages to ring upon the word rape. Mm-hmm. The word rape, the word ravishing, was used politically so frequently, especially around the 1688 revolution, so that the very title, The Rape of the Lock, makes one aware that there were other things, greater things, kingdoms, liberties, that had been raped, allegedly, by one side or the other. One of the changes Pope made between the first and the second version of The Rape of the Lock was to add the description of a game of cards before the actual lock of hair was snipped off by the ravishing baron from the lady's head.
Right.
Now, that card game, a brilliant piece of work on Pope's part, constantly alerts the reader to affairs of state, to kings, to rebellions, to wars, to betrayals, and thus does remind that the whole image of rape was a political as well as a merely sexual and playful image.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to move forward in time. How is it that poetry and affairs of state present themselves today, here in the late 1980s? You've remarked that the force of poetry isn't necessarily as marked now as it was in the Renaissance in the 18th century, but it's still there.
It certainly is still there, and I think that one of the things one might want to look at, if one were trying to find some continuity between the work I'm doing and the present time, is one would look at protest songs, mm-hmm. protest songs of the 60s, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Not to trivialize, but you're talking about things like Peter, Paul and Mary and Bob Dylan, that sort of thing.
I don't think that a reference to Bob Dylan is to trivialize.
Fair enough.
But yes, uh-huh. this is right. But it does also seem to me that poetry in our own time, and I think now the novel, and even drama, has not perhaps in a pejorative sense, it has turned inwards. It is not much excited or enlivened by political situations. And I think the reason for this, in the West at least, is that for all the faults of our society, and God knows there are many faults, mm-hmm. we do enjoy a remarkable period of relative stability, relative affluence. And we are not threatened by what governments do mm-hmm. in the way that in the East people are. And once you are threatened by what governments do, then of course writers need courage, more than our writers need courage.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow from that danger and that courage, frequently, very strong poetry, very powerful literature will arise. Solzhenitsyn would be, of course, a case in point to mention there.
Would you call us, that is to say, citizens of the West, would you call us complacent with respect to poetry and affairs of state? Need we necessarily live in a totalitarian atmosphere to appreciate what the poets are up to and what they're doing?
Well, that puts it all rather the wrong way round, I think. If we are complacent, we are not complacent about poetry. We are complacent about the state of the world.
Poetry is a symptom.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Poetry is not the problem. Poetry is the symptom of a strange attitude that we have.
Mm-hmm. Howard Erskine Hill teaches at the University of Cambridge. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Howard Erskine Hill worked on a study of poetry and affairs of state. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring Joseph Lowenstein of Washington University. Joseph Lowenstein is at work on a study of Renaissance creativity and the book trade. Here is Joseph Lowenstein.
The question that we usually ask is, in what way does a writer, does an artist, does an inventor feel and experience an attachment to what he or she has done?
Mm-hmm.
Money is obviously one way in which we feel attached to things. Nowadays, an author, when he writes a book, when she writes a book, sells it, you know, often gets an advance, but then can expect continuing influx of money on a manuscript. Well, that means that you watch its sales, you're concerned with it. You feel that you, in a way, are consistently out there in front of the public. The experience of attachment to a piece of creation must have been different in a time when there was no such thing as royalties, when there was no such thing as copyright. When your continuing commercial relation to the products of your labor were ephemeral.
Mm-hmm. How far back do we put this idea of intellectual property, Joe Lowenstein? Is it as simple as fixing a date and saying from thence forward we associate the notion of ownership with intellectual property? How do you date it?
Well, it's very difficult to date. In the 6th century B.C., we're told in a book on the history of cookery by Athenaeus, a book called The De Nephiste.
The original Julia Child.
That's right. In that book, we're told that the Sybarites promised a one-year monopoly in particular recipes to anyone who invented a good recipe.
Uh-huh.
But we don't find that kind of monopoly rights in something created very frequently before the Renaissance. And that's why a person writing the history of intellectual property has a lot of work to do suddenly in the middle of the 15th century.
Do you associate the idea, Joe Lowenstein, of intellectual property with a particular writer, a particular school of thinking? I mean, we have all these wonderful subcategories when we talk about the Renaissance.
Well, now, mind you, I'm not just interested in intellectual property. I'm not just interested in writing.
Fair enough.
I'm interested in new techniques that someone thinks of for manufacturing.
Invention.
Uh-huh. Intellectual invention that has to do with industry, that has to do with literary creativity, with creativity in the visual arts. I'm interested in the whole complex of developments in which people feel have a commercial relationship, and not just a commercial relationship to their work. It seems to me that one of the key moments in the history of English intellectual property had to do with the establishment of public theaters in London, because suddenly there were two established ways of disseminating literary creation. There was print, and there was also these permanent public theaters in London. And you suddenly see a kind of competition for control of dramatic texts between printers and acting companies.
Now, these companies would be the Globe and,
the acting companies established at the Globe, at the Blackfriars theaters, at the various public theaters and private theaters in London.
When does this begin to take on a codification in terms of in legal terms? Do you nail it down with respect to here's a law that says you owe me X for performing?
Well, it's very easy to date the beginnings of English statutory copyright. England had the first copyright laws in Europe, and that is in 1709. Mm-hmm. I'm actually working on the history of intellectual property before there was a codified statute. In England, in the 16th century, we start finding people trying to guarantee, for example, an inventor of a manufacturing process appeals to the crown to have a monopoly in that manufacturing technique for a limited amount of time. Let's take the case of Ben Jonson in the 17th century. Ben Jonson is an actor and a playwright. He sells his plays to acting companies for a pittance, really. And the acting company performs them, makes money on them, and occasionally will say the theaters get closed because of plague, or say, for some reason or another, they're willing to part with their exclusive control of the manuscript, and they'll sell it to a printer.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they'll sell it for rather more than Ben Jonson sold them the script in the first place. Now Jonson, he's an acute businessman. He's got a good sense of the marketplace. He notices that someone else is making money on his creative activity.
And what does he do?
Well, what Jonson did, and he's really remarkable in the history of English literary activity. Jonson arranged with a friendly printer to gather up all of his play texts to secure, by various agreements within the Stationers Guild, the Printers Guild, to secure the rights to print those. And he printed all those works together in a book called The Works of Ben Jonson. It was a very pretentious title, because really only classical authors had their writings gathered up, and they were published as works. This was a posthumous
activity.
So
just parenthetically, even then there was a battle over the canon. What's venerable, and what's
right.
The inheritance and all of that.
That's right. Well, So Johnson lives in this culture where the works of the ancient past are gathered up and presented in this very pretentious format, the collected works, the opera omnia.
Oh, goodness.
So Johnson arranged to have his own works, while he was still alive, presented in that same format, and he published all his collected works under the title The Works.
Did he make money on this? I mean, that here you began with that as a, you know, his acute sense of the marketplace.
No, Johnson doesn't get royalties. Indeed, we don't seem to find a sophisticated system of paying authors royalties until the late 17th, early 18th century. But what Johnson can do is he can take this big volume. It was published in 1616. It was the first such really big collection. And he can sign copies and give them to patrons.
Right.
It used to be that authors would secure their livelihood. Playwrights sold their plays to acting companies, but poets, for example, would write dedications to their works
to a patron
and hope to secure some kind of pension from a patron. Starting in about the middle of the 15th century. All over Europe, particularly in Venice, we start seeing governments protecting inventors of new manufacturing techniques. This caught on. It caught on in England. And we start seeing a new respect for intellectual innovation and ways of making that pay. One of the things that I'm arguing is that in an environment like that, in which an entire culture is beginning to value in new ways and to protect in new ways intellectual invention, writing, painting as well, becomes a different kind of activity. All thought becomes somehow affected by this new commercialization of thought, this new protection of commerce and thought. In fact, I mean, you might be interested to know that it's not just authors whose creativity comes to be protected, guarded.
What have you got in mind?
Well, there's a wonderful business about Rubens. It used to be, you remember,
the painter,
right? Rubens, before in Europe, before there were photographic reproductions of paintings, you could only see a painting. You know, you'd have to go and see it. There was no way of getting a look at it, except in engravings. And indeed, lots of Europeans found out about the paintings of the great masters through seeing engravings. It's fair to say that every time a new medium is invented for the dissemination of information, the notion of what creative activity is gets transformed. The notion of what a work of art or what an idea is gets subtly transformed.
Now, we went through something similar to that with the rise of VCR technology,
exactly.
the ownership of the creative impulse.
One of the things that we don't see so much, or which is hard to see now, is the importance of the regulating of ideas by the state. That's something that we forget about. But the genesis of copyright laws and patent laws in the early modern period has a great deal to do with state regulation of the economy, state regulation of ideology.
Mm-hmm.
The protection and the regulation of printed books in the Renaissance was not just an economic matter. It was one of the reasons why the Stationers Guild, the Printers Guild in London, was given the exclusive right to print in England. Only the London Guild had the right to print. Was that the English Crown wanted to be able to supervise what ideas were disseminated? The protection of property rights and ideas is a trade. Between the crown and printers and writers.
But that's certainly no longer the case. I mean, we have a widely disparate, diffuse, printing industry, and yet we still have attempts at control, to put an ugly word on the table, censorship. What's the difference between then and now?
Well, then censorship was accepted as a perfectly appropriate activity, a way of protecting the populace at large from heretical or seditious ideas in
part,
a way.
Part of the prerogative of the crown.
That's right, part of the prerogative of the crown, and indeed the crown thought of it as its responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays we have laws that attempt to control the freedom of the circulation of ideas.
Very quick footnote to our conversation, Joel Lowenstein. Who owns your ideas? How much do you think they're worth? How do you figure that out?
Oh, I think they'll be useful to people, and I don't feel exactly proprietary about this work. It's the work is so much more valuable when it's in discussion, when I'm presenting it and hearing how people respond. It seems to me that this work is most valuable when it becomes a community property.
Joseph Lowenstein teaches at Washington University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Joseph Lowenstein worked on a study of Renaissance creativity and the book trade. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 458. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about physics and philosophy. My guests will be Barry Lower of Rutgers University and David Alpert of Columbia University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in July brings us Bowdler's Day in recognition of the birth in July 1854 of the English physician who undertook to purify the works of Shakespeare as well as parts of the Old Testament. Thomas Bowdler's name is synonymous with puritanical censorship. The second week in July marks an anniversary for the fall of the Bastille in 1789 at the onset of the French Revolution. Birthdays during the second week in July include those of Marcel Proust, the French author, Clement Clark Moore, the American author of A Visit from St. Nicholas, Anne Radcliffe, the English Gothic novelist, and Henry David Thoreau, the American observer of nature and journal keeper. Marcel Proust was born during the second week in July, 1871, Clement Clark Moore in 1779, Anne Radcliffe in 1764, and Henry David Thoreau during the second week in July, 1817. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Poetry and Affairs of State and Renaissance Creativity, this week on Soundings. Listen for Howard Erskine Hill of Cambridge University and Joseph Lowenstein of Washington University. Howard Erskine Hill discusses his study of poetry and politics in English literature. Joseph Lowenstein talks about Renaissance creativity, the book trade, and intellectual property. Poetic Politics and Property, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.